This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
Number 45 Foxtrot, radar contact, 4 to the northeast of Santa Monica.
We're heading into the clouds now at a 45-degree angle out over the Pacific Ocean from Santa Monica Airport. There's a little turbulence as we bank back east towards San Bernardino in a four-seater, single-engine airplane. The pilot is Kate Scott.
SoCal approach Cherokee, 7645 Foxtrot with you, 5,000 climbing, 5,500.
Kate and 12 other women and one man piloting small planes in a race to commemorate the start of a women's pilot organization called the 99s, named after its first 99 members. It started way back in 1929, right after a race that began in Santa Monica, just like this one.
90 years ago on this day, right here at Santa Monica Airport, 20 women took off in the very first all-women's national air race. And they spent nine days, going to Ohio. The very first day, they stopped in San Bernardino. So that's what we're gonna be doing today to commemorate that air race.
Southern Californians are rightfully proud of our aviation history. The first air meet in the U.S. took place right here in 1910. The Douglas Aircraft Company opened here in 1922, and it all led to the aerospace industry. Now, usually women aren't the main characters in those stories, but they were flying at a time when they were just getting the right to vote, taking flying lessons, performing air stunts for the budding film industry, and of course, piloting their own planes. Reporter Victoria Bernal rode along on the recent commemorative race and tells us about today's pilots and the ones they're here to honor.
Okay, here's a story about the National Women's Air Derby. Well, the first one, 90 years ago this month, sometimes called the Powder Puff Derby. It's so fascinating, I can't believe it hasn't been made into a movie.
The women flyers who are going to be contestants in the great National Women's Air Derby.
It has all the makings of a blockbuster, starting with some amazing women. There were 20 of them. You've heard of Amelia Earhart, right? She was one of them, but there were others not so famous. Take Phoebe Amelie. She was arrested as a drug smuggler when she landed in Santa Monica just before the race. Local officials just weren't used to seeing women pilots before.
And she did wing walking. She stood on her head on the wings. She went from one airplane to another while they were flying in the air. She's crazy stunts, really crazy stunts.
Like Ruth Elder, a Hollywood film starlet.
She was the first woman to attempt to cross the Atlantic. She actually fell short, had to ditch in the ocean, didn't make it all the way across. But I think it was only a week later or something that she went ahead and joined this air race. So she really bounced back from, you know, something that was seen as kind of a failure in the media.
The Powder Puff Derby wasn't all smooth skies for Ruth Elder. Her mat flew out of the open cockpit. She had to land in a field to figure out her location. She waved off some curious cows that started to lick the plane, and then she took off for the next stop. And then there was Pancho Barnes,
who was this heiress from Pasadena, who was very unsuitably married off to this pastor. And she was this hard-drinking, cigar-smoking, foul-mouthed woman who was a stunt pilot and did whatever she wanted.
Pancho Barnes and a few others accidentally detoured to Mexico on the way to Ohio, prompting her to paint Mexico or bust on that plane. There was also danger, breakdowns, crash landings, so few had to bow out because they couldn't get back into the air.
Originally, the men didn't want them to fly alone, and they were going to insist that they had a male maintenance person fly with them, but they said, no, we want to do this all by ourselves, and we can do the maintenance on our planes. I mean, those things were breaking down left and right at that time.
Sometimes their altimeters worked and sometimes they didn't. And they flew hours and hours and hours each day with very rudimentary instruments. I couldn't imagine their instruments. It was literally a lawnmower strapped onto a frame at the time, not even metal, wood of an airplane. And I can barely reach the rudder pedals as it is. Even with some of the adjustments that we have now, I can't imagine the kind of gerrymandering they had to do in their own aircraft to be able to operate it. They were incredibly brave and talented to make that trip.
Finally, there was heartbreak. One pilot, Marvel Crossan, she died during the race.
She had flown the entire course before the race started, so she knew the race course. Her travel air was found demolished in the mesquite jungle in the Gila River Valley, and her body had been thrown from the airplane. Apparently from carbon monoxide poisoning was why her plane went down.
Ultimately, 14 pilots crossed the finishing line. One of the winners dedicated her trophy to Marvel Crossan. Soon after the competition, those air derby racers reunited and invited more women pilots to join a new group. 99 women signed up, and they called themselves the 99s, which is still very active.
And the Dodger Stadium is going to be coming up on the left here.
Flying to San Bernardino today is a lot easier than it was in 1929. No one worries about a map flying out of an open cockpit. But like those pilots 90 years ago, today's female flyers enjoy and rely on the camaraderie of other women in the sky.
I feel really honored to be a part of the 99s just because it's just cool that women flew in 1929 and there was like a handful in the entire world. And I just feel honored to be a 99, even if I'm like number 6,733.
Today, women only make up 6% of all pilots, which is still pretty low considering how much time has passed.
There's also one other thing which people have been talking about it in other industries as well, is that the car, for example, and so in the case of the aeroplane, is not built for a woman. Is in fact, they test them for safety on men, and there's loads of products that are like that. So if you're slightly taller or bigger, you're fine, but if you're smaller, quite often it's quite hard to reach the pedals or see out because the dashboard's quite high. They haven't redesigned planes for a long time. I think it was worse way back in 1929. They really genuinely were designed only for men. Little better now, but not much.
While many find inspiration from those pilots past and present, some find it from their family.
My passion for aviation started with my father. He was an aircraft mechanic in the United States Air Force. And I used to sit in his aircraft and that he was working on and imagine myself flying them. So that's where it started for me and going to air shows as a little kid. So.
And what does your dad think of you now as a pilot?
He is extremely proud of me, and you know, he was a mechanic, and I actually get to take him flying now, so that's very exciting.
I did ask my mom to be my teammate because she is one of the bigger inspirations in my life, and she, when I was a baby, tried to learn how to fly planes, but then didn't finish her license. So I thought it would be a nice little tribute to her.
2-9 or 9-3, and I'll get Foxtrot. Thank you, 4-5 Foxtrot.
Getting ready to land at San Bernardino Airport. The air is hot. It's dry, with a haze hovering just at the foothills. The plane is bumping around as it's about to kiss the ground.
Thanks for all your help.
Thank you for the visit.
All right, so maybe there's no movie. But a few Southern California artists did create a musical based on the 1929 Women's Air Derby called The Powder Puff Pilots. It's yet to have its world premiere, but they did perform a few songs to welcome everybody to the San Bernardino Airport, which just happens to have a grand piano in the lobby.
The clouds are softer, the winds are lighter, as peaceful as a prayer.
With this 2019 race complete and the medals given out, pilots debriefed each other about flight paths, race times, and recent adventures.
It's also a chance to get to fly with women in modern day, which is really exciting. There's so few of us in aviation, and to get to meet people that have the same passion. And I just got my license a week ago, so
Honestly, I think the more that young women, girls, old women, I mean, I started flying very late, and I'm helicopters, airplanes, whatever, and I'm, you know, I'm poor and have no godly reason that I should have made it this far. But you know what? I think when you see somebody else who's done it and you see somebody else who's doing it, then you realize that you can do it too.
Thank you to pilots Kate Scott, Connie Schur, Eloise Dykman, Marion Partee, Eve Lopez, Madonna Ray, Aaron Desi, Samara Dalrymple, and Andrea Garcia. And I'm Victoria Bernal, flying into the sunset for KCRW.
She can fly with the best of men, a glad soul with a need for speed. And true flyers never die, they say. They just take to their wings and fly. When I walk out where those legends played in the quiet Mojave twilight, oh, I could swear I heard laughter flying by.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The Lemley name is an iconic one in Los Angeles. Carl Lemley was one of the founders of Universal Studios more than a century ago, and many members of his family migrated to the United States from Germany to work either with him or near him in the movie business. That's how the Lemley Theater chain came to be 81 years ago, and it stayed small and independent all those years with 9 locations across the Southland showing mostly indie movies on its screens.
Oh, I believe in yesterday.
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
That was the movie Yesterday that came out earlier this year. But how we watch movies has changed a whole lot since the 1930s. And now the Lemley Company is, quote, exploring options, according to the LA Daily News, for a total or partial sale of its cinemas. And that is raising some serious questions about the future of indie films and the theaters that show them. Amy Nicholson is film critic for The Guardian, and she hosts the podcast Unspooled. Hi, Amy. Welcome to KCRW.
Hey, Steve. Always great to be here.
You bet. The news of the sale hasn't been confirmed. This was, as I mentioned, a Daily News story. The Lemleys are waiting to see who bites. But does this mean that a sale is imminent?
Yeah, I mean, imminent in theatrical terms is a long imminent. It could be anywhere from months to maybe a year. Yeah, as people remember from when the Landmark theaters were sold a few years ago, that was a deal that took 9 months for it to transfer from Mark Cuban to the new owner, Charles Cohen. But on the table, or enough for all of us to start thinking, like, what does this mean and what are we going to do about it?
Well, what does it mean? Because they specialize in a certain type of movie. I mean, does it mean it will go away? Does it mean that, I mean, we just don't know, do we?
Exactly. I mean, what makes Lemley really distinctive here in Los Angeles? I mean, this is the chain where their motto has been not afraid of subtitles. You know, they put it in big, bold buildings, on big things on their marquee. It's kind of punk rock, you know,
but that
really is who they are in this climate here in Los Angeles. They're the people who show the Polish film that might get an Oscar nomination. They're the people who show the really fascinating documentary about the honeybees. They're the people who show all of the stuff that really is the breadth of what film culture can be besides the gigantic Avengers multiplex hits. Another thing that's just really interesting about the Lemley chain, as they've always been, is this is the theater that actually has been at peace with not making money. A lot of the times they'll show films and give 100% of their box office to the film itself. I mean, Max Lemley, who founded the chain, he was really known for bringing up from Europe, as you mentioned, filmmakers that he thought were important, like Godard and Bertolucci. He brought over Almodovar later in his career, Fassbinder. He said, maybe I'll lose money showing these people, but these people are important. And that's really what this company has stood for.
So they've tried to compete with the bigger movie chains, but then they're like, we're not afraid to, you know, show subtitles. They went vegan, I think, at many of their locations earlier this year. They have a Christmas Fiddler on the Roof sing-along tradition, which is really cool, very local. It's been running strong. They renovated their Santa Monica, I think it was the Monica Theater right over on 2nd Street. So they've been doing all these things. They're even moving forward with the construction of a new theater in Old Town in the Newhall Pass area. So they've been making some big efforts. I mean, what happened? I mean, it seems like this came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, all those things you list, you know, the new options on the food. I mean, popcorn is usually vegan, but they added a vegan chicken nugget, upgrading their seats, having these events that aren't just movies, but events for the community to come. This is sort of the advice that the exhibition community has been getting for the last 10 years. Like, how do you stay relevant? And some of that advice has been bad and ultimately discarded. You know, 10 years ago, everybody was telling theaters if they didn't have all 3D screens, the world was going to end and they'd never have all the James Cameron hits. And now the advice is more geared towards good food, good seating. And I think these things still really, really matter. But ultimately, you know, the crisis here isn't just that audiences aren't seeing independent films in theaters, it's that they're not seeing original films in theaters. And as a film critic, I feel really two ways about this. On the one hand, it's great that I can talk about a little movie, and now for the first time in, you know, my whole career, people around the country can watch it on streaming that night. It's great. It's terrific. In a way, indie movies are more accessible than ever, but it puts theaters who have done this really great work for decades in a questionable position.
Do we know who might be interested in buying such a chain? Because we talk about Landmark. Landmark was probably its biggest competitor, and Landmark's a national chain. Lemley is just here in L.A.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the group that bought Landmark, who is the Charles S. Cohen Media Group, he's a billionaire and a cineast. He's one of the people who has been maybe whispered might be interested in doubling down on his efforts to really keep the theatrical experience alive. He's also a real estate investor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other people have been mentioned are all pretty interesting. There's Regency, who is a local group here. This would really fit into their profile of being an art house theater that's very California-centered. Other people who are talking about it are kind of interesting. There's Reading Cinemas from New York. They own the Angelica over there. But the two most interesting potential purchasers that people are talking about, and it's hard to say right now if it's wishful thinking or strategic thinking, are Netflix and Amazon.
Mm.
I mean, Netflix, as you know, just bought The Egyptian.
Yeah.
And Amazon is also really looking into getting more into the theatrical space because these are two groups who are known for streaming movies, but they want Oscars. And if you want Oscars, you have to have your movie in a theater.
So where do films go if people want to watch them and all these indie film theaters, these cinemas, go away?
I mean, they will be online, but where these films get attention is almost the more important question because we're in this birth of there's so many independent and foreign films coming out here, so many documentaries, that for them to get attention, a lot of times it means being an Oscar contender. And that's where the Lemleys really fit into our ecosystem, is that Lemley was the chain that really worked with independent films, documentaries, smaller profile things, films from Poland, and said, this is how you get a nomination. This is how you qualify. And so if Lemley drops out of this world with that role that they played, it means a lot of small foreign films are going to have a harder job getting attention in the Oscar race. And that is what really scares me. It's a domino chain effect.
What about the film studios, the ones who make those indie films? I know Harvey Weinstein was one of the big drivers early on. He was at Miramax, right? And then created the Weinstein Company. Obviously, his fortunes have fallen. And, you know, what about these film companies that are making independent films? Do they still want to do that? Is it still a profitable thing?
They do. But what I feel like I'm seeing happen is that the independent film, as we knew it maybe in the 90s when Miramax was winning all of the awards, is shifting a bit. Those are slightly bigger budget things, slightly bigger budget endeavors. And now it feels like the landscape, this pie that we have called independent cinema, is being divided up by many, many, many more companies, many, many, many more filmmakers working in digital, working cheaper. But it also means there's much less audience attention they can snag. So budgets seem to have lowered overall, and what qualifies as success seems to have shrunk. It's interesting. I mean, if you're an audience, you have more options than ever. But if you're a filmmaker, I think it is getting harder to make your money back, to make this a worthwhile investment.
And that means you got to keep trying to find the money to make it in the first place. And people sometimes just throw up their hands and are like, yeah, maybe it's not worth it.
It's all about the money, man.
It's all about the money, but there's also the art, right? This is LA. It's about the art, too.
Thank you. Yes, it is, and it should be.
And it should be. But if you don't have the money, it's hard to make art.
Oh, man. Yeah. What are you doing? You're depressing me here, Steve.
It's like a catch-22. Amy Nicholson, film critic for The Guardian, host of the podcast Unspooled. Amy, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, coming up next, L.A. is known for its palm trees, of course, but how about those other trees? You know, the ones that provide shade and cool the air and beautify the neighborhood? Turns out there's a new tree czar in L.A., that's coming up on Greater LA. It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. They clean the air, they cool the air, they provide much needed shade. In a hot region, a region that's getting hotter. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa promised to plant 1 million trees. Now, Mayor Eric Garcetti has appointed a city forest officer to look after those trees. Alyssa Walker is urbanism editor at Curbed LA. She's back to talk about what's going on with all the trees in LA. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, Steve.
Talk a little bit, Alyssa, about why trees, though, shade trees, the ones with the big canopies, why they're important, particularly in this hot urban environment.
Right. So trees do two really important things for a hot city, right? The shade that you can feel when you walk underneath them. It's very noticeable when you're standing under a tree or when your house is under a tree. It provides cooling benefits to both you and lowers your air conditioning bill. But trees are also doing something else. They're cooling the air by evaporating water from their leaves. So a tree that makes a canopy with another tree, the kind that, you know, you see those beautiful like archways as you're going down the street where the trees meet in the middle, that is what we want. We want a canopy that's continuous to double the cooling benefits. And then trees clean the air. So all this particulate matter from vehicles, the smog, all these problems that we're having with air quality, trees can help with that too.
We mentioned at the outset that Mayor Villaraigosa, a few years ago, it's been a minute since he did it, but he promised to plant 1 million new trees. He made it about halfway to a little more than 400,000. Sounds like a lot of trees, though, right? How's our urban forest actually looking?
So what happened, and we're not going to technically blame it on the change in mayorship. A lot of things happened after Villaraigosa was mayor. We had a recession. It meant a lot of cutbacks when it came to city staff and people who were taking care of the trees were no longer out there maintaining the trees. We had a drought then. So we had a lot of trees, especially street trees, that were dying because people stopped watering parts of their lawn and then also decided not to water trees. And so we had this kind of double whammy when it came to our urban canopy. So we had taken this really great inventory of the health of our trees and been taken good care of in the 90s. We haven't really done that since then. So we don't know how many trees have actually died. We don't know what the health of the trees that are still there. And we also have seen a lot of development at the same time. So a lot of our canopy is just on residential land. And if you're going to build, say, an apartment building, you're going to take away some of the land for trees, but they're not planting them back.
So then what are the rules, Alyssa, around developers and homeowners who maybe are cutting down trees, or do those trees get replaced?
There's been a lot of interesting studies, actually, that have shown where we've lost the most trees in the last few years. And it actually has not been the multifamily developments that have been going in. You think of that. You think of a building growing its footprint and to house more people or get taller. It's actually been people doing, like, the McMansion trick on their property. So having a smaller house and then creating a larger single-family home. And you got to take out the trees in order to get the construction equipment in there.
Yeah,
to
because
make your,
you got to build that
yeah,
house
you
all
make
the
your
way
living
to the
room
edge.
Bigger. Right. Exactly. And this is where we've seen a lot of losses of trees. City of LA is a little bit not as strict when it comes to what you can cut down. And what they were doing was saying, okay, developers, you can cut these trees down as long as you buy a few extra trees for us and we could put them wherever. But the problem was they just weren't getting planted at the same rate. Now we have an in lieu fee that they're calling it, where they collect a fee from the developer and use it to plant trees where they're needed.
And the person who's been charged to look after this process is a woman named Rachel Malarich, who Mayor Eric Garcetti appointed to be the city's first ever city forest officer. She's an arborist, certified arborist, knows a lot about trees. She spent a decade working for the group Tree People. What is her specific job? What is she being asked to do?
So she's going to be, as LAS called it, the Lorax for Los Angeles. I feel like that could be Lorax, just her official title, someone to speak for the trees, right? So I think she has a really interesting job at this moment in time. We know the climate risk that we're facing as a city. We know that temperatures are getting hotter. We can feel it. So she's been given two goals that have been set up by the city: to plant 90,000 trees by 2021 and to increase the canopy cover by 50% in low-income neighborhoods. There's the residents who are experiencing the benefits of trees. There are not that many of them. You talk to some people and they say, I don't know that LA has a tree problem, because they live in those neighborhoods where all they see is trees. A lot of neighborhoods have no trees, no street trees whatsoever.
All right. Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor for Curbed LA, regular contributor here. Alyssa, as always, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, that's it for today. Next week, a musician who began his life in Burbank but had dreams and some nightmares in Hollywood. And KCRW's Jason Bentley joins us as he moves on. After more than a decade at the helm of Morning Becomes Eclectic. I hope you'll stay tuned for that next week. The Bookworm reads you a story next on KCRW. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, PJ Shahamet, Sarah Pellegrini, and Christian Bordahl are the dream team of this show. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great day.